You are listening to an exclusive podcast on Money Control.
Hi and welcome to Money Control. I'm Priyanka Sahai and you're tuned into Setting Sail, which is a brand new podcast series that we've started to bring to you some of the country's best known entrepreneurs. Now, becoming an entrepreneur takes a lot of sweat and blood. And in this series, the idea is to understand how these top guns negotiated the pitfalls in their lives and eventually got ahead of the established legacy players to make a name for themselves in this industry. Keeping this in mind, today we have a very prominent name of the internet ecosystem with us. He started off his company at a time when not many even knew about internet in India and yet went on to grow his company to become the country's leading online travel agency. That's right, we have with us Deep Kalra, founder and group chief executive of Make My Trip. Thank you so much, Deep, for taking time out for us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
All right, Deep. So online travel, as it appears, was not your first goal, or maybe if I can say, was not the only idea in your mind when you were trying to set up a company. You were also having and trying to figure out how the online trading market would go forward. Or for that matter, there was a second idea that is commonly being talked about in terms of sale of secondhand cars. So were these your plan Bs, and how did you zeroed in on travel as a segment?
No, you've clearly done your homework well. So one of them is correct, the other isn't. This is way back. I think the idea started coming to me way back in late 99. I was working with GE Capital then. To be honest, my driving force was not so much the sector I'll be in, but the driving force was actually to be on the internet.
Right.
I think B2C is something which came to me naturally, so I wanted to retail internet. And within that, as you looked at the different verticals, travel was definitely one of them, but online stockbroking was the other one.
Sure.
I think on secondhand cars was more an exposure I got while at GE. We were looking at a company at Automart India pretty carefully then. We'd spent some time with them. It seemed like a good market. For me, that was a turning point because I actually sold my wife's secondhand car on one of these sites.
Okay.
And it convinced me that there was
a market.
There's a market, and there was a clear value add in terms of disintermediation.
Mm-hmm.
So one could tend to get a much better price. And simply what was happening was you were going direct, you know, consumer to consumer.
Mm-hmm.
So it was very clear that there'll be other such markets. I think the more I wrote out both business plans, stockbroking as well as travel.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I just went with my heart more than my head.
Okay.
And I'm glad I did. Travel seemed far more interesting, mm-hmm. far more exciting. I've always been a fond traveler. And it just seemed like an area where I think an individual or a group of individuals could make a difference versus something like online stockbroking, where I think having the backup at that point of time, at least how things have changed in 19 years, having the backup of a large financial institution, i.e. a bank, would make a big difference.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I tended towards doing something which would be even more entrepreneurial on my own.
Right.
And I'm glad it was travel. I mean, I couldn't have asked for something better. I've had the ride of my life.
I'm sure that it was. And let me take you through how Make My Trip was started. And, the company was started in the year 2000, very much around the time when the dot-com bust had actually happened. And this was a phase which eventually saw many internet giants collapsing like pack of cards, like house of cards. And you're famously known for being one of the entrepreneurs who survived the dot-com bust, and not just survived, even went ahead taking your company, getting it listed on NASDAQ. Can you tell us a little bit about that phase and how eventually did you manage to take the company out of that moment?
Sure, and at the risk of boring some of our listeners, because I think this story has been oft told, but I'll try to just put it in a capsule.
Absolutely.
Definitely, I think I'm a stubborn person, and it's nice to say resilient, but mm-hmm. I think entrepreneurs should be stubborn. It helps. You should be stubborn if you believe in your idea.
Right.
I don't think any great business is made overnight. In fact, when I talk to young entrepreneurs even today, I oftentimes tell them, please give enough time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, don't expect to see wonders in 3, 4, 5 years. It takes maybe a decade to build a good business in India. Things might have got a little faster today because it's become a very fertile ground with so many people online, payments becoming easy. But you're absolutely right. In 2000, it was a very different scenario. In fact, when we launched our site in October 2000, we actually wanted to be the defining place for people traveling to India, from India, and within India. I actually want to do it all. So when I look at that business plan now, while many parts of it make me laugh because it was very different, I guess, very naive at that point of time, but I'm happy to say that the from India and within India is still our core focus today.
Right.
Ironically, what saved us during our first 5 years was the to India, which basically meant inbound travel. So what really happened was for the first 3 months, October, November, and December, we actually launched and started marketing in all these markets. So in India for people to travel domestically and to travel overseas, and in the US for non-resident Indians to come to India.
Okay.
Why that market? People were already used to buying online.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a degree of comfort. Also, one of my senior colleagues who eventually became a co-founder had actually worked in that market, KUR, and he had a deep understanding of that market. And ironically, what we realized in 3 months was that in India, very few people were still ready to buy online.
Okay.
Everyone wanted to research online. Everyone mm-hmm. wanted to get an option and then take it to the offline travel agent and said, internet pe ye mil raha hai, isko match kar do. You know, that's what was happening.
Right.
So we became a de facto search engine, but it didn't pay our bills because
the transaction weren't quite happening.
Yeah, so we call it very poor conversion, or like I like to say, we had lots of lookers, very few bookers.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not a great scenario.
Okay.
However, as we compared that at the same point of time of what was happening in the US, we actually found a much healthier conversion ratio.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because people were used to buying online. Amazon, Expedia, Travelocity were already around since 96, 97. They had got people comfortable buying online and trusting the internet. It's hard for us today to think about how big a deal trust is online. It's hard because most of us live online. But all you need to do is to talk to your, you know, grandparents or parents or anyone above the age of 60 today. Or you need to talk to someone from a tier 2, tier 3 town who's not socially that confident
mm-hmm.
and ask them, are they ready to buy online? Have they bought something online?
Right.
So talk to a person who's never bought anything online and you'll realize the barrier. It's a huge barrier. People are worried. People are, you know, concerned. I will give my credit card and I won't get the goods. I won't get the services, etc. I'll show up at the airport. I won't have a reservation. I'll show up at the hotel. I won't have a reservation.
So much of uncertainty.
So much of uncertainty. Of course, if you talk to the top, when I say top, I meant people on the internet, the early movers, you talk to the 100 million people who are already buying online.
Right.
They're saying this is second nature. What's the big deal?
Of course.
You know, during a commercial at a cricket match, we order our meals, like we all know. Or while driving back home, I quickly make my flight bookings for the next morning to go wherever I have to go. As I land, I make my bookings for a hotel into that town. You know, I press for a cab without even thinking twice about it.
Right.
And I'm paying in all of this,
course.
But it's happening subliminally because I'm used to it. So anyway, to cut a long story short, US market was already ready. They were buying online. That kept our fires burning. So to be honest, I think the best decision we made in hindsight was to stop marketing in India
mm-hmm.
on 1st of January 2001.
Okay.
We stopped all marketing. We kept the site live,
mm-hmm.
but we didn't waste any marketing money.
Okay.
That was a great decision because then we conserved money. And there were at least 19 other travel.coms at that time. Most of them you wouldn't have heard of today. And they all perished because I think everyone kept burning more money. In fact, your typical response is, let's do some more advertising.
Mm-hmm.
Let's do some more promotion,
okay.
etc. There were no cashbacks then, thankfully.
Okay.
But you can't change habit. It takes
right.
a long time. So it was only in 2005 when we had the confidence to launch again in India.
Mm-hmm.
And why? Because I think two big events had happened. One was I would give a lot of credit to IRCTC from Indian
of
Railways.
Course.
Because in
it
2003 when
ticketing.
They launched, by 2004 there was a good number of people who were paying online and comfortable. Now where did they get their confidence? Two reasons. A, it was a government enterprise.
Mm.
In our country we trust the government,
yes, yes.
which is good. The second was they were solving a real pain point.
Mm-hmm.
The pain point was the only other way to buy a train ticket was to go to the railway station
mm-hmm.
or send someone.
Yes.
Stand in a long queue, reach the counter, sometimes to be told that you have no seats available. It was a really difficult experience. And we've all done it. At
mm-hmm.
least anyone over
yes,
the age
of
probably 35, 40 has done it. But then suddenly you had this portal from Indian Railways where you could see all the choices, see if there are seats available or even book waitlisted. And get done. It was huge.
Mm-hmm.
So people said this works.
Okay.
So the credit card barrier online got kind of, I think, breached and you know, people got comfortable with it. The second was very specific to our industry. Low-cost carriers launched in India at that time, and Air Deccan was the first. And Air Deccan was advertising these mouth-watering fares like 999 from Bangalore to Delhi, or, you know, just really low fares.
Okay.
And people were saying, wow, I want that. So they called up their travel agent. The travel agent actually, ironically, didn't want to sell that fare.
Okay.
They didn't want to sell it because the low-cost carrier model was that they paid little or no commission.
Okay.
Secondly, the moment you paid for a ticket, it was done. You had to pay online.
Okay.
So if the travel agent paid online and you as a customer changed your mind on the phone or after 1 hour, the travel agent was out of pocket.
Okay.
So we found that a very interesting problem to solve with technology.
Mm-hmm.
Technology being, we build direct connects with all the low-cost carriers through technology. We gave the customer now the choice. Here are all the choices. This is what's available. You want to pay, you get your ticket. You don't want to pay, you don't have to. Mm-hmm. Or you can pay more for a full-service carrier. So we provided for the first time, I think, in the history of India, Indian aviation or online travel, we gave the customer the power. So the power shifted from you made an informed decision and you risk the payment yourself. So I think this gave us a great launch pad, and we launched with a very simple promise, which is just come to our website and get the best fares. And that was the brief given to the agency. Thankfully, it really did well. So 2005 onwards, when we relaunched in India, I think between 05 until 2010, there was a dramatic increase. We moved from about 2 million in revenues to about 40x that number.
Right.
Or, if I would put it right, about 20 million in gross bookings to about 500 million. So, 25x in those 5 years.
Okay.
We IPO'd on NASDAQ in 2010. I guess we were one of the first few companies to do that. Even now, very few Indian companies listed on NASDAQ as a standalone listing.
Mm-hmm.
So we've been public almost 9 years now, and yeah, it's been fantastic.
Great. You know, coming to the NASDAQ listing part, not many internet companies that have spent like a decade in the ecosystem right now are still actually ready to go the public way and make my trip, given that, you know, you started off in 2000 and you went on listing at the company in the next 10 years. What really motivated you to get a listing done in just about 10 years? Was that the norm at that point in time? And do you think the ecosystem has changed in the last many years, and these startups, the next generation startups, will take maybe another 4 to 5 years, half a decade more to go through that process now?
Yeah, so firstly, I think from our point of view and my personal aspirations, as well as with the other folks with me, especially Rajesh, my co-founder, I think it was always for us, an IPO or a listing was something which we were very keen on.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason was we felt that that will take the company into another league.
Right.
It gives you access to public funds. At that point of time, we hadn't decided India versus US, but we were very keen to actually take the company to the next level. And you must bear in mind, at that point of time, the private markets were not as deep as they are today.
Mm-hmm.
So for the current set of companies on the internet, there is one more option, which is to raise a very large round of private funding.
Of course.
You are not public. Therefore, you know, there are many things you may or may not enjoy, or there might be more overhead which comes with it. There definitely is.
Sure.
Listing in US isn't easy. But I think the more people told us that, listen, US will be very difficult. There's a lot of scrutiny. It's very onerous. It's much harder. List in India. I think the more we both got excited that, you know, what could be that hard? Also, I think we were very confident that we ran not only a very clean shop, of course, but more than that, I think we were very process driven. We were proud of the fact that, you know, we could stand scrutiny for anything.
Mm-hmm.
And so we decided to list in the US. And from the day we decided to listing, it was just 6 months, and that entire credit I would give to Rajesh, who was the CFO then.
Sure.
He drove that process hard with our auditors and our bankers and our lawyers. And it was exhilarating because you actually do a long roadshow, a couple of weeks. You meet public market shareholders and investors who are very different from private market.
Right.
Around the world.
Mm-hmm.
So while most of it was in the US in different city every day, we also started from the Far East, so Singapore, Hong Kong, and then the US. And then by the end of it, you have a good sense of the money you've raised. We had actually raised 15x of the amount we wanted to. So our IPO size was 70 million. Mm-hmm. We had raised over a billion.
Yeah.
So it was a great position, including Greenshoe. It was 80 million for us. So there you have full discretion on who you want to award how much.
Right.
Very different from the Indian laws. So it's pretty exciting when you're doing that on the eve of actually your listing. And I think we built up a very good kind of investor base ever since. Many of them are still investors. They've done well. We listed at $14 as a per share, 14 US dollars. In some sense, you can say we've doubled from market cap basis because we've expanded the number of shares. On a market cap basis, when we listed, we were 450 million. Today, the company is anywhere between 2.7 to 3 billion. So I think most of our investors have really enjoyed the upside. There have been ups and downs. There have been difficult times. In 2012, Kingfisher went bust. And with that, the entire Indian aviation scene got shaken up. So we all got hit quite badly. At that time, we were 85% dependent on air tickets. We very consciously changed that product mix. Today, we get less than 40% of our revenues from air. We actually get more than 55% of our revenues from accommodations, mainly hotels, but holidays.
Hotels as well as
hotels and
the
holidays.
Other verticals that you
So we've very consciously changed that mix so that we are, I think, in a much more robust position today.
You know, Deep, you've invested in so many companies. What I also wanted to know through this was that how these companies, what is the psyche of these companies and the founders? Because we don't quite hear a lot of IPOs in the pipeline at this point in time. Do you think that the IPOs are being delayed and what has been the reason behind that?
Investments through MMYT or investments, personal investments?
No, I'm talking overall. You've been an investor in so many startups.
Yeah, I've been fairly actively involved. Actually, I've changed my own thesis, to be honest. I think to be full-time running a company in this very exciting space and to be an investor is pretty hard. So now I've actually gone more and more through the fund route. So I have given, you know, whatever funds I wanted to put with startups, I've given them to four or five funds. And since they have the expertise, they do this day in, day out, and it's a much better situation. And then I'm able to meet, you know, once a week an entrepreneur where I can add some value. Through TIE, I'm very active there. I'm on the board. I've been a past president. I mentor and I try to spend time with young entrepreneurs. I really enjoy that, actually. That I think is a lot of fun. It keeps you on your toes as well. What I find is that the ecosystem has definitely matured a lot. I don't think too many people are seeking IPO today, like I mentioned earlier, because there is no dearth of capital in the private sector. So that's the fundamental change.
Sure.
You know, you have the capital, you can keep growing. Even if you look at the US, a company like Uber, you know, postponed and kept delaying going public, and now they'll be going public probably soon. For the longest time, because they could raise so much money in the private markets. So I think that's part of the reason. But why I think it's matured a lot is I find the young entrepreneurs today far more aware of what they're getting into, far more, I'd say, astute. They understand what it takes to build a great company. And you're seeing a lot of breakout companies. So it's like fantastic to see some of these companies do so well. You know, really, I think, rub shoulders with some of the finest companies around the world and build solid companies. So I think India now has actually arrived on the internet scene in a big way. It's not like, oh, there was one Naukri or Info Edge, or there was one Make My Trip. And then everyone said, oh, there was before that, there was Rediff.com. And then there was like a big lull and you'd struggle to find, you know, really good companies around India Mart, etc. And then now suddenly I think we have a whole slew of companies. And the reason is, A, I think the ecosystem is ripe. We were talking about 50 million users online, 30 million, going to 50, going to 100. Now we're talking about 500 million people online. I think the smartphone has changed a lot, and definitely 4G and cheap plans have changed a lot. So I think you've got to give credit to that. In our time, we started, there were no mobile apps at all. Apps are like, you know, whatever, I guess 5 years old or whatever. Before that, it was all desktop. Desktop penetration has frozen, and that 121 million number is pretty much the same. All the growth now is coming through mobile, which means it's omnipresent. Aggressive pricing plans like Jio have brought people online, first for entertainment and social networking. And then beyond that, people start discovering more and more. So you have just so many fantastic companies. I think it's really good.
So essentially, there's no dearth of capital in the market. And that is why there's no like immediate need for these startups are feeling to go up.
I'll just qualify that there's no dearth of capital for good companies.
Okay.
So if you're a good company, a solid right. company, good founding team, solving a real problem in a market which, like investors like to say, which is a large market, mm-hmm. there's no dearth.
Okay.
You know, we all read the papers and there are big raises happening, but most of those companies you'll find very good entrepreneurial teams.
Okay.
Very clear, very focused, very driven on the problem they want to solve.
Mm-hmm.
Great at technology, great at product. I think they're the ones getting a disproportionate share of the capital, which happens everywhere in the world. Mm-hmm. So I think we're kind of replicating what happened in China over the last few years, what happened in Silicon Valley before that. And you're seeing breakout companies there, definitely.
Sure. And you know, 2010, you listed and it took you not more than 6 years to create a history by going ahead and acquiring not just any other smaller company, but one of the biggest rivals you had in the India market. The GoIBibo acquisition actually happened. According to a lot of reports, it's a public information that Lee Fixell was one of the person who actually somehow started off the talks. There was a brief pause, and after that you met Ashish Kashyap at a common party where the conversation started off. Why don't you tell us a bit more about that? And we would like to know more on the emotional front, because at the end of the day, what we know is that acquisitions, mergers and acquisitions have never been an easy task. And this, especially at a point in time when, you know, these are two big companies in the internet ecosystem. How did it all started? And, what do you think went right, which led to this acquisition actually happening?
Sure. I'm always amused at the amount of folklore and rumor which happens
yes.
in the whole thing. So let me set the record straight.
Fair enough.
I think Lee's role in this was pretty small. Lee's
okay.
a dear friend.
Okay.
I had actually, Lee had invested in our company through Tiger in 2007 and 2008 in two rounds. And we've been friends ever since. I think I can take credit for the introduction I made for Lee at Flipkart.
Of course.
So I think he was finding it really hard. I remember to meet with Sachin or Bini for whatever reason. They had not heard of him. I knew these guys. And I told them that, listen, he's worth meeting, he's a good guy. And we were both in Bangalore that
right.
day. And then the rest, as they say, is history. He signed a term sheet in their first meeting.
Yes.
And that shows his brilliance and his conviction. So while we did talk, I think Lee did know Bob at Naspers. We had a conversation which went nowhere, actually, for various reasons. But how it started was actually a conversation that I had with Ashish. I'd known Ashish as a small ecosystem. Ashish had actually brought folks from Naspers to my office several years ago.
Okay.
And, you know, that's perfectly all right to tell them about the ecosystem out here. I think they were moving from gaming to travel.
Mm-hmm.
And we laugh about it now. And we met at a cold February night in Delhi at a farmhouse at a party, and we started chatting. And that was the time we were really competing head on.
Mm-hmm.
And I think GoIBibo had made their mission that we are going to catch up in the number of hotel room nights that we do, literally at any cost. And they were private.
There's a lot of cost, but cash burn there.
Well, they were private, and Naspers were 100% owners. They could keep bankrolling them. We were public, so we were answerable not just for growth, but also on the bottom line.
Sure.
And that had obviously this battle continued for over a year and a half, almost 2 years. It was, you know, putting a lot of pressure
yes.
on our margins. We were bleeding as well. This was the time where we would have gone, you know, positive, but this was pulling us down. And then it didn't go anywhere. Around the same time, I think both the companies, actually all OTAs, were also hit by a pretty infamous service tax case, which finally we emerged victorious. We won in not only in High Court, we also won in Supreme Court. We've got our money back. But it started then. So we were pitched together because of that. So it was all the OTAs together, including GoIBibo, Yatra, ClearTrip, us. We were all in the same case. Mm-hmm. So we were meeting and we had a common problem which we were trying to solve. So I think one thing led to another, and I did mention to him that, listen, we should think about this more rationally and long term. You know, let's not think about this just today. And he was quite, I think, forthright about it. So I appreciated him. I'm sure they're also hurting at some point, which
of
we got
course.
To know later. So, you know, very importantly, Priyanka, firstly, we really very consciously call it a merger. And the reason I call it a merger was I was very clear that what we were getting in this company was not only a brand or a piece of software or something else. I was very excited about the team. So when I did meet beyond Ashish, I met the rest of the team. I was actually blown away with the quality of what they had built on technology. So I started seeing them beyond just being a discounting shop. I got privy to some of their softwares. I looked at what they used with their hotels. And I can tell you with a lot of pride today that entire team now is still very much with us. It's been more than 2 years. The software that they had built, we call it an extranet that independent hotels use to connect, is the software which is powering both brands now. Redbus was part of the transaction, and Redbus still runs as an independent company with the same CEO and CTO who were running it then, Prakash and Anoop. And I think it was great that it worked out as a merger, because we've grown as a company, not just in numbers and size, but I think in the quality of people and technology. It's really made us a nimbler, a faster, and a much better company. So it was a defining moment for us. This was January 2017. And I think we've only got much stronger ever since.
Do you talk about a market share now? How much of market share is being captured by the merged entity now?
Yeah, it's public information. So when you're public, you know, a lot of stuff has to be public. So the way to look at our air market share is 25% of all flyers in the country actually are our customers through brand Make My Trip, which has about 17-18%, and through brand Go Ibibo, which has about 7-8%. So that's a fairly large market share. If you look at it of the online travel market, it's larger, but we'd like to look at it all flyers. But this is only domestic.
Sure.
The moment we look at international outbound, so when you take a flight from here to Bangkok or Dubai or London or New York, that's much smaller. So there we would be under 10%, but we are very keen to grow that. If we look at the hotel space, only, you'd be surprised, only about 10-12% of all hotel rooms are booked online today.
Okay.
Of that, we have a lion's share, but you know, it's a very small percentage. So I think the game there is to change the habit from booking offline to online. So there's a long way to go out there. In bus, we have a very healthy market share of private sector bus. So private sector bus, we would be, you know, between 1/3, even 40%. But public sector bus is still very low penetrated by online. And I think there's a long way for us to go. The holidays market, which we're very excited about, and we're trying to move it online as fast as possible, is highly fragmented. And you know, the market share of no company will be in double digits. So there's so much of headroom, we're actually excited. So I prefer markets where our market share is low, but we are leading because there's so much more to do.
Right. And having said that, given that you've invested across so many startups in the Indian ecosystem, and I remember, and correct me if I'm wrong, there was a conference that was happening and you were sharing the dais with Bhavish Agarwal, and the two of you are very aggressive about preferential treatment that should be given to Indian startups. Now, India is an open market unlike China, and you know, what we are trying to understand is, what is the rationale behind asking something like that, and how is that important for the Indian market at this point in time?
Actually, the ask is pretty simple, and both Bhavish and I are founding members of an organization called India Tech. And what we are trying to say is that I don't think anyone's talking about protectionism. All we are trying to say is that this is a sector in which a lot of capital is required. Most of the founders and entrepreneurs are first generation entrepreneurs. They don't have a lot of money of their own. And you need tons of capital in these businesses, especially if they are B2C. So willy-nilly, the entrepreneur will get diluted pretty fast and will have pretty low shareholding by the time you're actually a mature company, ready to go public, or you know, have enough clout to become a market leader. So we want to make sure that these founders will then not be disadvantaged. And we want to actually borrow a leaf from what's happened in the US. So if you look at Facebook or you look at Google, you look at a lot of these companies, the founders actually enjoy super majority voting rights. So we're trying to say that, listen, that would make a lot of sense for this market where founders can still be in control, despite shareholding be with other shareholders. It doesn't matter if they're Indian or overseas. We're just talking about the founders and their ability to keep driving their company, even with minority shareholding. That's fundamentally the ask out here.
Which is a different thing from asking the government to give preferential treatment to the startup. This is more like a maybe a first right or preferential voting right that
that's
founder
one.
Gets signed on a term sheet when investment has happened, or that's the shareholding pattern that you're talking about.
Correct.
In
and
this
we're talking
space.
About supermajority shares where you actually have more voting rights for every share if they're with the founders. The second one, what we're trying to really talk about is a level playing field. And all we're saying is that, listen, in some cases, and I think with GST, we're trying to correct a lot of this, but foreign companies are able to actually bill customers in India from an offshore entity,
right,
thereby not needing to pay tax in India, whereas GST is pretty high, but Indian companies have to pay it. So we think that's unfair on the Indian company, mm-hmm. and the government's very receptive. They are hearing that. So I think there's a chance we'll be able to do that. The third ask for us is really listing.
Mm-hmm.
So listing in India today is pretty hard if you're not profitable. You
yes.
can do it through book building, but it's a difficult process. The, you know, we're saying, but then why are we letting Indian companies go outside and list? Like if in India it was easier to list, I think a lot of these companies would list
would
in India. So
in
we're
India.
Putting up recommendations to SEBI. And I think they've been quite receptive. So that's really what we are asking for.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think there's a they're all very pro entrepreneur, pro-founder, especially in new age industry. And I am very confident that most of these, they will see light of day pretty soon.
Mm-hmm. So it turns out that the Startup India and Stand Up India program has actually been a boon for the startup ecosystem, and with the elections coming up, what would you like to say? I mean, what has been the achievements of the Modi government on that front? Do you think, and I have been speaking to a lot of entrepreneurs, and would you agree if I were to say that in the last 4 to 5 years, startups have been recognized as a very different set of people, as a very different set of builders in the space, which wasn't quite there, say, half a decade down the line?
Yeah, I think firstly, I'd like to compliment the current government to at least call out startups separately. Startup India was something which happened first time about 3 years ago. There has been a follow-up, perhaps not a Startup India, but there was also a conclave with a lot of founders, which was like a follow-up, Champions of Change,
mm-hmm.
which happened about a year and a half
yes.
after that. There's definitely a lot of focus given, I think, right from Niti Aayog, PMO downwards. I think everyone is very clear that startups will play a very big role in economic growth of this country, and particularly in our biggest pain area at a macro level, which is job creation.
Mm-hmm.
I think everyone is clear that only big companies can't give jobs. We have to actually create many more job givers.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, very often we talk about, like, listen, don't be a job seeker, be a job creator, which means even if it's a SME or an MSME, which is a really small enterprise, but maybe you can create jobs where you can employ 10 people, 20 people, 100 people. People are doing
sure.
that. I think that's going to be critical for India going forward. We're not going to be able to do it just by having, you know, thousands of large companies and then job seekers alone. Also, I think it plays to our strengths because I think Indians are fundamentally very entrepreneurial. So that platform and that recognition is there. The internet provides a great place for all of this to take off. I think we'd like to see, more follow through, like the angel tax fiasco, which happened sometime
Absolutely.
Back, I think is highly avoidable.
Okay.
And now remedial stuff is being
mm-hmm.
done. So
mm-hmm.
just yesterday, they announced new regulations around it, how the filing and all will make sure that there is transparency and this kind of misunderstanding won't happen. But that misunderstanding caused a lot of pain.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we've got to recognize startups. And, you know, if there's a tax holiday, that's wonderful. But there are various other pain points and grievances which have to be recognized. So I would even recommend a ministry specifically for startups, just
right.
like Singapore has, where you can, you know, register a company online in 10 to 15 minutes. A single window and a mm-hmm. single nodal agency where
yeah.
you can bring all your troubles to, I think might be the right way to go to really foster growth in this area. I think we're missing that, and that would be fantastic.
Great. That sounds interesting. And one quick last question, Deep, that I try and ask all the entrepreneurs that I meet for this podcast. Now, everyone that I come across would talk about hectic lifestyle and, say like 18 hours work shifts. Now, you've been in this business and I think it will be safe to say that by now you think, I think you settled down to a large extent and the company is now flourishing. You have a family, you have two beautiful kids,
your wife and you are based out of India. I understand that your children are studying abroad. Now, what do you have to say on work-life balance? How important is that in an entrepreneur's life? And do we get to see enough of that in the Indian ecosystem currently?
You want an honest answer?
Of course, yeah. An honest answer.
I think it's pretty hard to do in the early stages.
Yeah,
I was speaking at another leading online travel online company, not travel company, yesterday at a kind of a all-hands town hall. And someone asked me the same question. And I said, there's a time for it, you know, in the early stages, at least for the core team, not just for the entrepreneur, for the core team, it's pretty hard.
Okay.
So the first 5 years were brutal because we also went through about 3 or 4 years where we could have shut down any time.
Yes.
So I think it's survival. And if it's survival, then you got to do everything. I think then hypergrowth time also, it became a little better. I think we stopped working Sundays, but we worked Saturdays for the longest time. Long hours. I don't think 18 hours is sustainable too long because I think everyone needs time to recharge. But definitely days range between 12 to 15 hours for the longest time.
Right.
And then what tends to happen is, I think it's also age and stage of life.
Mm-hmm.
So it changes. I mean, you know, of course, everyone wants to spend more time with their family. At least I can speak for myself. I think you've got to find the right balance. The beauty of our business is that you can actually work from anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So I think a lot of us, at least, that's what I started doing over the last 5 years, I think, consciously. Yeah,
okay.
Maybe from 2012, 2013, 2-3 years after IPO.
Mm-hmm.
I think very consciously I said, listen, you know, there's going to be a family time of, you know, a couple of hours where, you know, you won't fix calls, you won't do things. And then the good part is you can go back to work from home. So today
sure.
Our work happens from anywhere. So I would carve out like a, you know, 8:30 to 10:30 or 8 to 10 p.m. or 9 to 11 p.m. is just pretty much family time. And then you catch up and you sacrifice something else. You probably sacrifice sleep,
okay.
Which is, I'm sure it's not healthy in the long run. But yeah, you have to ease out. I mean, I know people who set a scorching pace for themselves and I've seen them burn out. So I think at some sort of level, your body will only tell you how much you can take. And if you don't delegate, then you're going to make life pretty miserable for yourself. So I think I've been lucky to have great guys around. And today we have a fantastic team, so I'm quite comfortable to, you know, let go, which I think came to me quite naturally. I'm a professional turned entrepreneur. It's not like, you know, I'd never worked. I'd seen 3 professional companies
yes.
where work was done in a different way. So it was very easy to hire good people and give them, you know, enough latitude to work as, you know, entrepreneurs themselves. And I think that helps a lot. So, yeah, I think it's not great to be empty nesters. Which is what we are today. But I think over the past 5 years, I found decent health workings. And I encourage all my colleagues to do the same. So we are very, very clear that at this company, firstly, we want to get mums back to work. And we really, really have done a lot. Even before the law was 6 months, we would give 6 months.
Oh, wow.
We had a creche for the longest time in the building. And a lot of people are taking to that. We make it easier. We give flexi hours. We have an unlimited leave policy, which people find very exciting.
Mm-hmm.
So we are firm believers. If you're not having a good time at work and if you're stressed out at work, you won't give your best.
Right.
And we're willing to compromise maybe something in the bargain. But I think that's very important to me, to Rajesh, to our head of HR, to all the leaders.
Mm-hmm.
But you're still quite focused on what you want to get done. So I think you want to build a company for the long term. You've got to think like that. So I think we've had our crazy times
mm-hmm.
and our, you know, frenetic pace times. And today we've got to strike the right balance between, you know, people who want to build long-term careers out here. And that's what we're doing.
Interesting. So just to sum this up, to begin with, you'll have to be on your toes. But as days pass, you can take some leisure time out and you definitely have to maintain a healthy balance between your work and life. I think that is what
That's fair with one caveat.
Right.
You've got to build the cadres of management.
Okay.
So if you don't build strong cadres of management and you don't build get good people around you and you let them, you know, give them again, you know, enough space to work, then that'll never happen. So there's some people who can't let go, then they choose a life they want to, and there are people who can. So I think if you can delegate, you can let go. Also, we're very proud about the fact that we've been, you know, consistently rated as one of the best places to work.
Sure.
And we're very proud about that and we want to keep that going. I think that's very important too.
Interesting. Yeah. So on that note, I would like to thank you, Deep, for taking time out for us. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
So meanwhile, if you have any comments, you can write down to us. Our email ID is mcpodcast@aw18.com. And with this, we'll wrap up our very special episode of Setting Sail. We'll be back next week with another guest on board. Till then, for more news, views and updates, stay logged on to moneycontrol.com.
This has been a Money Control presentation.